You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast. I'm the annoying British guy who hosts this podcast, and I should say my name's Jack Benyon. If you've not listened before, that's quite an interesting intro. Alongside me is JR Hildebrand, the reason you do listen to this podcast, because of his fantastic insight. JR, how you doing? Did you enjoy the championship finale?
I listen because you're on the podcast, Jack.
Oh, look at that. That's just too nice. You're going to have to say something horrible now to balance
it out. I did enjoy the race. It lived up to the, after qualifying, it was seeming pretty questionable whether or not we were going to really have a meaningful championship finale, I feel like. And I guess the thing that we didn't really touch on much in the last pod leading into this race was just that despite the fact that the gap at the front was such that we needed for some somewhat extreme circumstances to play out, particularly after you watch qualifying, it seems like, okay, Dixon's mid-pack, Joseph's all the way at the back, Will's on pole. This seems unlikely that this is, you know, going to become super interesting for the actual championship leader. But that there were battles throughout the field all the way to the final corner of the last lap that ended up dictating where a lot of drivers ended up, which I think is something that even as a driver, you don't always pay that much attention to. You're kind of thinking like if you're in championship mode, or, you know, I mean, I can even think about this in the context of like racing at the Indy 500, you know, like some of these big events that you sort of think of as only as being like win or bust, like nobody cares if you don't win. Well, actually, as a group, you do end up caring where you finish, even if you didn't win. You know, like I've definitely had situations where you make some low odds strategic call that you end up finishing like outside the top 15 when you were running inside the top 10. And that ends up kind of pissing you off afterwards, like after it's all settled down and it's all said and done. So I thought it was cool that throughout the course of this race, you definitely saw a lot of scraps throughout the field, and it ended up turning out, you know, McLaughlin and Ericsson, basically the two of those guys, where they were running, whichever one of them finished ahead of the other one was going to end up finishing ahead of each other in the championship. So some great battles throughout. The star of the show, you know, the star of the show, I guess, was Alex Palou for just destroying everybody. He didn't get a lot of airtime because he was just out in front for so long. So Joseph really going back to the front was impressive to watch. But altogether, I think a championship finale that definitely, you know, lived up to its billing, and I think we've got a very worthy champion, and just a completely stacked whole top 6-7 of the order when it's all said and done.
We should probably say at this point that Will Power won the championship, just in case anyone didn't know that. That's probably a key piece of information we should probably put out there. You mentioned qualifying, JR, and I wanted to kind of pull you up on this and a few little kind of elements attached to this. I think the first one is that I think Will Power's kind of in the wrong championship, because if he's in Formula One and delivers this level of performance, like where qualifying is actually a really significant and important thing, then we're looking at like a 4-8 time champion here rather than a 2-time champion. So I think that's one thing worth pointing out. But we don't often discuss qualifying on this pod for that reason, basically, that it's so inconsequential, mainly in IndyCar. Obviously, I think over the course of a season, you need to have a certain average to be, you know, considered a contender. But race to race, it doesn't necessarily always mean a lot, like Joseph Newgarden showed in the race at the weekend there, where he came from 25th to second. But this one felt really significant to me, JR, because, you know, not only did Power break Mario Andretti's all-time pole record in IndyCar, but he did it under the most intense pressure that you get, basically, in terms of, obviously, he's fighting for the championship, and he knows that a pole sets him up in a really good way, and that he knows if he's on the podium, then he's going to win the championship. So it's already setting him up in a great way for the race, but also comes in the context of his contenders all kind of, if you don't describe it as them cracking under pressure, then it's them not delivering in a key moment. So for me, I was kind of going into this weekend, you know, thinking that Power would be a worthy champion. But in the back of my head, I had like thinking about Iowa for Joseph Newgarden and what that would have done to his points, thinking about the 1 mph difference that Scott Dixon had in his pit road speeding penalty at the Indy 500 and what difference that would have had. By the way, that would have won him the championship before he even got to Laguna Seca if he'd have won the 500 there. So I'm going into that thinking all of these guys have a legitimate shout at why they should maybe be the champion. Even Pato O'Ward, who had those two kind of top fives taken away from him, would have been right there. We spoke about him on the podcast last week. But in this moment, you know, Power arguably delivered his most important performance of the season in that qualifying session because of what he was able to do under that pressure. It, tell us, from a driving perspective, you know, you've driven under, I guess, maybe not exactly the same circumstances because not many people have, but similar pressure situations like that. I guess it kind of comes back to Power's kind of mental situation that we've seen from him this season and what he's been able to deliver in these moments. How difficult is that as a driver just to be able to go and lay down a lap like that and do it, you know, in arguably the most pressure point, you know, the highest pressure filled situation of the season?
Yeah, I guess I don't recall which of these front runners was the one that said it in, it was over the course of this weekend in an interview. I think maybe it was Dixon that basically said, you know, you win championships based on what happens on your worst days. And that's how Will Power won this championship to a T this year. But mixed in with being able to be absolutely excellent in some of these super high pressure situations like this, and to be able to go out there and put the car on pole at Laguna, is Will Power is in your mix of five guys that you're thinking going into the weekend, and it could have been anywhere in the season. It could have been any season. Like, we could be talking about 2008 in Champ Car. We could be talking about 2015. We could be talking about, you know, this as the finale, whatever. Will is among the guys that kind of any of these types of qualifying sessions, he seems like he's you think of him as being somebody who's going to be, you know, in the mix of drivers to be able to pull that speed out and run that one lap on used reds, because we know he's just so good at that. But when you consider the fact that, right, wrong, or otherwise, Will has developed a bit of a, I don't want to call it a reputation, but that he's not always delivered quite in this way in these types of situations. And that he's come into multiple other championship finales as the points leader and not always close the deal more often than he has. I guess as a driver, that's not, you know, there's a lot that goes into those things playing out the way that they do. Like, I don't look at Will Power and think he's somebody that he lacks the mental toughness or something to just go out there and crush everybody and like treat this weekend the same as he treats any other weekend or whatever. But he just kind of, you know, there are other drivers that over the course of, or over the span of time that Will has been a contender in this championship, that have seemed like they've been able to do that a little bit better than he has. And this year, we've just gotten a completely different version of Will that, you know, I mean, I think I said it on the pod prior to going to Portland that it's like, it just sort of feels like he's going to close the deal. And that's not, I can speak not for any particular reason that I can like put my finger on, but I've not felt that way about Will Power at the end of seasons generally in the past. And I think that speaks to him recognizing that there's something more that he can get out of his experience driving the car with his team in his career. It's kind of all of those things together. And he's gone out and sought out whatever that is, however he's, you know, we'll end up talking to him. It's sort of, I expect him to be rather coy about, you know, actually answering questions about this, because for any athlete, they're very, when you find something that really works, you're just going to be concerned about letting anybody else know what that is. You know, it's one of these little wrinkles in being an athlete that when you unlock something in yourself, it's deeply personal, deeply emotional when you discover that and you find it. And because like at the end of the day, the reason whether I think every race car driver or every pro athlete or whatever realizes this, I feel like I've been fortunate to sort of figure this out, is that the reason that you do it is for that feeling of really being at one with yourself when you're in the action of doing the thing that you do. And so when you can be in that moment, when you can, it's, I mean, part of it's just being in the moment, right? But when you can kind of have that experience, and your intentions are clear and you feel good about the way that your relationship is with the people around you, and kind of there's an emotional component of your team, and in motorsport in particular, your team and your family and the other people that are part of that, you know, kind of group or that network of other humans around you. When you get all of those things lined up, and you know that you can unlock that almost kind of like transcendent, you know, driving experience when you actually just go out there and do it, where everything kind of slows down and you just feel like, you know, it's happening as you think it's going to happen, and you're not surprised, you're not super reactive, you can just kind of rely on your body's like inner intelligence to do its thing. I love seeing guys find that for themselves, because it's, at the end of the day, it's like the thing that you look, it's the thing that you're always searching for. And that Will has seemed like a guy that, while he's had that, he has that in these, you know, insane moments all the time. I think it's why he's won the most poles in IndyCar history, is because over one lap, he's very good at locking into that kind of mojo and just going out and doing it. But this year he's found like a completely different gear, and it's obvious that he's thinking about things differently. He's thinking about that network, those relationships, the whole thing. And so for him to have like made that big of a transition in one off season and have it play out this way without seemingly having to like mess around, like, you know, retune very often throughout the course of the year. It's just super impressive. And I think to your point earlier, like to see him go out and jam it on the pole is just like, that's just like a, you know, if you're one of the other guys, you're just so deflated, you know, when Will Power goes and gets that one. But it's more than the point. It's just like, okay, man. So he's not cracking in the slightest. You know, like I'm going to have to go out and beat this dude at his best tomorrow. And so I think that knowing that you're in that position for Will Power, I'm sure gave him an incredible amount of confidence to actually go out and do it.
Let's not use too much of this gold about Will Power, because although I thought it was important that we cover him off and explain a little bit about what happened in the race here, we will be speaking to him later in the week. So definitely check back on our channels, wherever you listen to the podcast, because we will have an interview with Will Power coming up. So we'll talk about some of this stuff in more detail with him. I did want to talk to you about what felt like is, I mean, let's separate Alex Blowout for a second, because we'll talk about him later, because he was out of championship contention coming into this race. So I do want to talk about what he was able to do at the weekend, but I feel like the attention in the race was on Joseph Newgarden, because he looked like the most likely person who could stop Will Power winning the championship, basically. So I guess for a quick bit of context of how that happened, Alex Palou and Joseph Newgarden both started on the hard tyre, which kind of just worked out being the best strategy with the caution that came midway through the race. Like, I don't want to get too much into what happened lap by lap, but basically the caution worked out well for those guys. Newgarden had pitted not long before that caution, was able to stay in the top five where he was at that point, while other people were kind of pitting or waiting for their stop. So it worked out perfectly for Newgarden. Palou had already taken the lead at this point, because he was on the hard tyre from the start and started much further up. Obviously Newgarden was 25th at the start. You know, Palou starting a, you know, much higher up. So that's kind of how those two kind of came to the front. And we saw with Pelot that he was just able to gap the field and in a Herter-like fashion, basically. So we'll definitely get onto that. But with Newgarden, you know, not only was he able to use this tyre strategy, it's like we've talked about a few times this season, Alexander Rossi at Detroit is the example that I always use, that it sometimes it gets played off as strategy that someone's been able to come through the field like this, and it doesn't happen unless you deal with the pace to match it. So definite props to Joseph Newgarden for what he was able to achieve there, especially that late pit stop where he had to take, you know, two pit stops after the caution instead of the one that most other people took, and he was able to drive back through and pit and come out in front of Power, which was pretty awesome. The pace was definitely there. I guess everything fell apart for him in qualifying, where he got beached at the corkscrew, somewhat coincidentally, which was where he managed to do most of his overtaking on Sunday, and was really impressive, which was a bit of a sad coincidental kind of link. But I guess Newgarden throughout the season, JR has felt, you know, I guess Power has displayed that kind of mental bulletproofness, let's call it, that Newgarden usually, you know, it usually underpins every Newgarden season and every Newgarden race, every Newgarden lap. It feels like he's, you know, robotic in certain aspects. But it was quite an emotional interview he gave after the race, saying that he felt like a few times this season he feels like he's been at breaking point, and there's been a lot of pressure on him, I think, to help this team deliver in the context of, you know, losing Gavin Ward at the start of the season, a lot of new people coming into this team, and Joseph kind of being that figurehead and the person that everyone's relied on to remember a lot of the setup things that they've tried. And you know, we spoke about that earlier in the season with him on the podcast. Definitely worth going back to check that out. But yeah, just speaking about Joseph, JR, I guess it's hard to kind of rank where the season lies, because he's obviously won five races, but, you know, been incredibly inconsistent after that. But there's just been so much going on that, you know, it's been a really tough season. I felt like the qualifying situation was really what did it. But then in the race, we got the kind of the Newgarden we see when he's been hard done to or made a mistake and kind of drives with that, you know, steely determination. Was there any point where you kind of believed that he could actually take the championship in that race, or did it just feel a bit too far off for you? I guess we talked about Power and how bulletproof he kind of felt, you know, even in previous races, but especially, you know, this weekend, he felt like he was on top.
Yeah, I guess the only time that it struck me that I felt like the win was out of reach for anybody but Alex Pelot, basically. So
yeah, agreed.
There was a point, however, where Will was kind of struggling after a round of stops that he was on blacks, and they like took a turn front wing out. It's kind of in the middle of the race.
Yep.
That it looked like he was briefly under some genuine threat from both of the Arrow McLaren cars and Grosjean. And so you're looking at that kind of thinking, all right, well, if Joseph finishes second, Joseph was on the come up at that point. If he finishes second and Will's like, Will could end up falling back to sixth or seventh here or something, which still is, if all Joseph can get to is second, then that's that. But it was kind of before we had really seen Joseph's pace in clean air, apples to apples against Pelot, and they were closer together at this point. Like, they were kind of 15 seconds apart or something like that. And so you're sort of thinking like, all right, well, I don't know. I mean, Joseph, at least after the yellow, Joseph appeared to have, like, depending on how the pace has, how good his pace really was, that he could have gone sticker red to the end. And that maybe because the track's rubbered in or what, like, there was a little bit of, to me, there was sort of a moment there where it's like, you don't know quite enough about the direction that each of these guys is going to end up going through the rest of the race. That if Joseph, like, real, now he's in clean air, if he really fires off and has, like, you know, and has Pelot plus a Pelot pace, then some, and Will starts to fall back down the order, then at least you've got, you know, there was a moment where it seemed like that was feasible, depending on kind of what happened. It didn't surprise me that there was not a lot of yellows. We sort of talked about that prior to the race. Like, more often than not, you get in these situations where the cars have really low grip and you're just having to take it so easy because you're trying not to wreck the car like in every corner. And so you just leave that little bit of, unless you're on good tires and you really know you can trust it, you're just so dancing around on the edge that it almost like it, because you're right on that ragged edge all the time with either the front or the rear of the car, it doesn't like catch you by surprise as much because you're just right there always all the way through the corner from entry to exit. And so it's not necessarily, I guess I should rephrase it. It's not necessarily because guys are operating under the limit all the time. Like they're taking it super easy. They're just, the limit is easy to get to. And so they kind of always know where it is basically. So that was, I guess to me, it didn't really strike me that there was major threat of, unless somehow strategy ended up factoring in there late in the race, you know, that it ends up being an issue or being an issue for Will. I gotta say, I'm a little bummed to hear Joseph's reaction and kind of his vibe when it was over. I mean, in comparing to the way that we've spoken about Will, you know, Will has been focused very introspectively about what matters to him, which is like his performance basically, and taking what's available. And when he's been able to take what's available this year, he has not really seemed to care that much what that's amounted to in terms of where they finish races or where they qualify or whatever. And he's kind of on to the next thing. And Joseph has almost had this like hyper competitiveness that anything but pull lights to flag, just bury everybody every weekend is like an enormous disappointment. And I guess of the two of those outlooks, it's, you know, every person is different and kind of what generates performance for every driver is different. And there's a part you saw it throughout the race, like Joseph making a lot of those, Joseph getting through traffic the way that he did, period, is in part down to that hyper competitiveness, like that feeling of he's ultra assertive. Like it's like to hell with this, I'm going to the front, you know? And sometimes you can only make those moves if you're in that mode, but it seems like the difference, I guess, this year is just that it seemed like he's been in that mode 24/7, 365, not really like stepping away from it and taking stock of just like how impressive a job he's done. And, you know, at the end of the day, he can't affect a lot of the things that's gone on. I mean, even when they've had lousy, you know, qualifying in this particular situation in this weekend was his fault. But looking at the year, the fact that they've had such an up and down year, very little of that is on him. It's not like he's failed to execute at a bunch of tracks and that's why they've gone from winning to being outside the top 10 or something. They just haven't had like a super consistent season. They've made some strategic errors. He obviously had mechanical at Iowa. Like these are things that are not, Indy like didn't go according to plan because they ended up qualifying at a lousy time of day and, you know, whatever. It's like, these are things that I feel like Will Power this year has just completely blown off basically. And just looking at them, he's seemed much more at ease basically. And Joseph has seemed like kind of pegged a lot of the time. So I don't think that I don't say any of that to say that there's anything wrong with that, or that I think that that's somehow negatively impacted his performance. But him kind of admit, you know, saying that he's been at a breaking point, that he's been, you know, he's been like too hard on himself. He's all those things. I mean, I think that that's, I would say both as somebody that knows Joseph, but also just as a driver watching other drivers, that I think that's a fair assessment, you know? And I hope for his own, you know, sort of like well-being that he could find something that's kind of in between that allows him to be that dude when he's behind the wheel, but not have it be quite so consuming away from it, because it's been tough to watch him go through that process over the course of this year.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
All right, JR, we promised to talk about Alex Palou, so let's get into that, shall we? Absolutely, just dominant performance from basically from the minute he got into the lead. He was just able to reel off like 5, 6, 7, 8 second gaps in the space of like 4 or 5 laps, which was just, I think it's going to take a little bit more looking into the kind of race data and trying to figure out like exactly how he did that in its entirety. But I think a couple of things before I come to you, I wanted to mention that I feel like there's been, it feels to me like over the last two races, there's been a shift where let's say when Alex was asked in kind of victory circle, was it possible that he could be in the 10 next year? He was extremely coy in how he answered that. And it definitely feels like there's been some sort of shift whereby it's more likely that he could end up potentially, you know, staying there, because I think the, from what we've been hearing from inside the team and from various sources who kind of know the situation, what we've been hearing throughout this is that whatever happens in the legal case, it's unlikely that Alex will be racing with Ganassi next year. He signed for McLaren. He said he wanted to leave Ganassi, and it sounded like that, you know, whatever happened, that was unlikely. But it definitely feels like to me over the last two races or so in that time period that it's become a little bit more likely, can we say? I guess that's not quite the right way to phrase it. It's not totally unlikely.
Back on the table that he maybe stays at, yeah.
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's been some movement there, and the coyness in victory lane and Chip kind of just stood behind him, like kind of looming over him in the back of the back of the TV picture at victory lane there. It all just kind of, it looks a bit familiar to me in some way. And I definitely think from what we've heard that it's now, you know, more likely that he could stay next season, which is interesting. We've heard that we know that the second round of mediation is ongoing between Alex's racing entity, his party and Ganassi. So we'll definitely watch that with bated breath. We know Zach Brown said over the course of the weekend that he wants to finalize his, you know, kind of lineup by the end of the month. So I guess if that's any sort of update, that's a slight update based on, you know, a lot happening at the moment and the championship going on. But just getting back to the race, I think, you know, Alex he's been extremely consistent this season, but it doesn't feel like he's quite had the peaks that he had last season. I think a bit of that is maybe the team battle that's been going on and Penske and Chevy definitely having a, you know, an advantage this year in how they've been able to perform. I think they've definitely had a better season than Ganassi, whereas last season it seemed like Ganassi still had an edge, especially on the road courses where they've struggled a lot recently. So I think that plays a big part in it. But that performance from Alex Palou was, you know, it was a performance that we see from the likes of Colton Herta, and one that we talk about as something that really only a small, like maybe 5 drivers are capable of actually doing at the moment in IndyCar. You know, what did you make of that, JR? It seemed like basically that was the level of performance that we've come to expect from only a couple of drivers who are able to like take hold of a race weekend. And normally they come with being in the top 5 in both practice sessions, being on pole and then winning the race. Whereas with Alex, just kind of, I guess it's more reflective of Ganassi's, you know, road course pace. But at Portland in qualifying, he was the only driver at Ganassi able to to kind of stitch the qualifying together there and show that peak pace when Marcus and Scott struggled. And this weekend, he qualified, you know, pretty, the difference wasn't as big here in terms of qualifying, but when the race took hold, it was very clear that he had another step up on everybody else there.
Yeah. I mean, it was, to me, you made a bunch of great points there. And we,
oh, thank you.
We should say that we have now done on this episode, the Pelot down. It was interesting going through the weekend. Well, I think part of the pace maybe not being quite as obvious prior to that is just because throughout the course of practice and qualifying, it was like one lap qualifying to lay a lap down in any of those sessions throughout. And even in practice, it was basically that way, that if you got a little bit screwed up on when you were running the reds or whatever it was going to be, that you just didn't really see it. We did, however, see that at the test, Alex was like 0.4 faster than anybody.
Yeah.
And was significantly faster than the next Ganassi car. So there was a couple of things that surprised me a little bit. One was, I was not anticipating that he was just going to take off. But basically, you mentioned it earlier, but he went long because he was on blacks in the first stint, got into clean air, was fast at the end of the black stint. So he just, a little bit like Joseph did, basically had a pace advantage through lap 25 or through lap 20 or something. He didn't go quite as long as Joseph did, I don't think, but had a pace advantage even while the other guys were making pit stops and coming out on their next set of tires. And then once he went on, I think the second stint, he went to reds, went to sticker reds, I guess, and just like had a second a lap on everybody out of nowhere, kind of. So it was interesting watching. They didn't show his onboard very frequently, but they did show it briefly through one of the, you know, final stints. And I remembered this about watching him race here last year, which was just, he was so, it looked like a combination of factors to me. One was he had entry security the way that we see Colton have it when he just waxes everybody, that he's able to break pretty late and turn in pretty late into the corner without having to chuck a bunch of wheel at it. So he's got front end grip, like you can almost sense that like the steering is heavy at corner entry, but he's got the rear stability and he's rolling off the brake pedal, using the brake pedal in a way that he's not overtaxing the car at that late corner entry. But I noticed like even turning into turn three, there was a lot of guys that were sort of purposefully missing the apex there, like rolling just a wider arc through the center of the corner. Because if you add that extra bit of steering just to get down to the apex, you're forcing the car into understeer. You lose the front axle and then you're swapping to oversteer at the exit, and altogether it's just like not better. So you were seeing a lot of guys, if you were watching the race, a lot of the drivers that were running in the top five or eight, you know, they're sort of missing the apex in three, they're missing the apex in five. They're not working super hard at getting it in 11 coming onto the front straightaway, like all of these kind of, you know, weird corners throughout the track for different reasons. So you're doing that because sometimes you can, by steering less and by steering like through the middle of the corner on a less aggressive arc, that you just maintain the energy in the front tire. And so you can kind of just carve the exit, get a little straighter, a little sooner for the exit and get the shot off. What struck me about watching Alex was that he had both this entry stability that you see from other drivers when they're able to just, you know, kind of go nuts in these sort of situations. But he also, there was a smoothness to the way, like you then overlay the things that we learned about him from last year, just this ability to kind of know right where the limit of the car is and not really exceed it. Like he's not a guy that you ever see sawing at the wheel, you know? And so it was like the combination of these two things of him being hyper smooth, being able to just like find that sweet spot where he's got a little load in the front axle and just maintain it, not ever like steering too much or too little or getting to the throttle too aggressively to upset the car. And so I think that those two things in combination on this super high deg Laguna Seca track, just, you know, having the car and having this particular driving style that just doesn't overwork the tire and you can do it super consistently. You don't have to be exactly in the right place on the track. It's like driving in the rain a little bit. You know, like you're driving the car more off of the feeling through the steering wheel and kind of the behavior of the car, as opposed to like, I need to get all the way down to this apex within an inch every lap or else I'm just losing time. And so, but yeah, it was incredibly impressive to watch, just to watch the lap time keep coming. Like there was never a point that you thought, like there wasn't ever a point through any of those stints that anybody was faster than he was. So that was just impressive to see. And obviously, you know, you see that he's still got it after being a little bit all over the place at different points throughout the year. It surprised me, and they talked to Scott Dixon at the end, and he had mentioned that there were points when he was in clean air that he had Alex's pace. You know, they got into a situation where they had pitted early and kind of committed to, you know, doing a lot of stops or ending up in a situation where they were going to have to go super long when it kind of wasn't advantageous. You know, wasn't able to get through traffic the same way that like Newgarden was. It helped Newgarden to get through traffic. I think that they were sort of off strategy compared to a lot of guys. But, you know, ultimately, like to see that unfold and to see there not be another Ganassi car within sight, basically, was extra impressive when it was all said and done. There was, you know, a number of other cars that were able to kind of work their way up towards the front. And so for clearly the fastest car on the track to be a Ganassi car and not to have any of the others be able to really meaningfully replicate it, made it all that more impressive to see him just run away from everybody.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You mentioned Dixon there, so why don't we take this opportunity just to very briefly run through the rest of the championship contenders and where they finish. Obviously, we discussed Joseph Newgarden finishing second and Power third. We had Scott McLaughlin on a really interesting kind of unseen late race charge because all of the attention was on Power and Newgarden up front. But McLaughlin, I think he'd started the stint maybe 11th or 10th, managed to work his way past Rossi, Ericsson, and then Grosjean at the end. So McLaughlin was sixth. Obviously, he needed to win the race, and the fact that he committed to that early four stopper and then the caution came out definitely ruined any chance. I don't think
it seemed like basically they committed him to covering off Dixon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Basically from the beginning, like if he was ahead of Scott, so we're going to have one of the Penske cars just stay on Scott strategy and put another car between him and clean air at the front of the pack, basically.
Yeah, definitely covering off Dixon was the strategy there, and yeah, committing to the full stop before the caution was not the way to go. Marcus, we should mention, was ninth. He tried to follow McLaughlin through on Rossi a bit earlier in the final stint and didn't quite make it work. Seemed to be in the wars quite a lot through the race. He had a bit of contact with Herter at the corkscrew. He'd had some contact at turn one with McLaughlin, actually, I think, was with the contact there. So definitely... living up to maybe some of the calls pre-race from some people to be a bit more aggressive in kind of race combat. He was definitely that. But in a similar situation where, you know, he'd started on the softs, only managed to do 9 laps and then had to run a set of, well, I guess he didn't have to, but they used a set of used hards after the first stop to try and keep, I guess, fresh hards for the rest of the race. But another four stopper that didn't pay off. And Dixon, you mentioned, he finished 12th in the end. Wasn't really able to make that progress late on in the race, despite having a late pit stop. He was one who had to to make two stops after the caution. So yeah, difficult race for all of the championship contenders really that weren't basically Power and Newgarden. And I mean, Newgarden had a difficult race, but obviously had a good result come out of it. Two very quick things that I wanted to run through with you, JR. I wanted to flag up Christian Lundgaard winning the Rookie of the Year championship because I think that was worth doing. It definitely feels like, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, but I guess I'm just putting this out there for your opinion anyway. We had news earlier in the week that Ray Hall had signed Stefano Sordo, former McLaren F1 engineer and various roles in Formula One, is joining them as technical director. And yeah, I guess just since Sebring, really, since they had that test where they'd done some experiments with the dampers and stuff like that, you know, it initially looked like that might only impact their street performance because it was Toronto where they had that immediate breakthrough after Sebring where most people do their street testing. But then after that, they've just been on a really decent run and had some good performance. So I guess, do you share a level of optimism that I have there? Because I think, you know, making signings like people like Stefano Sordo won't just come to any team in any championship. Like, you're going to have to put forward a pretty decent proposal for him to come and join your team. They've signed Lundgaard, obviously one of the, you know, definitely an exciting prospect on the F1 junior single seater ladder before he came over. You know, I know the Jack Harvey move hasn't worked out as they would have liked in the first season, but I'm sure they'll have a lot of optimism for that, you know, working better in the future once the cars are a bit more sorted. And Graham's just been quite Graham this year. I mean, you know, turning not always the best qualifying into strong top tens and some decent results. So I have a lot of optimism for that team. And I think Lundgaard is the kind of the face of that optimism in terms of what he's been able to deliver in the second half of the season.
I totally agree. I think that, you know, when you look at Graham obviously ended up kind of rising to 11th, I think, in the points in the end, and finished ahead of Christian when it was all said and done. But you have to look at the performances that Christian's had as being really the highlights of their season and showcasing just that peak ability that if they do get things right and they're on, you know, kind of on target in terms of execution over the course of a weekend, that they do have the potential to be running up here with at least on a, you know, if inconsistently, like throughout the season at various different types of tracks, you know, with Penske and Ganassi and the rest of these guys that are up at the front. So you definitely see, you know, with their new shop and some of these hires, you can see that they're making a long-term commitment to getting better and having the resources required to compete with the best of the best in the IndyCar series. And I think all of those things kind of go together, right? Like seeing the performance on track, you've got a veteran in Graham, you've got a young guy that's showing a lot of potential. I mean, you know, Christian was a couple of scenarios over the course of a couple of events this year away from potentially being a race winner or a two-time race winner. I mean, at Portland, it kind of all went away, but he's been in that mix as much as anybody that isn't, you know, isn't a consistent title contender basically has been in the second half of the season. And so I think that you got to be bullish on his ability to continue to learn and get a little bit better. And to your point, Jack making a comeback next year, kind of taking an off season to figure out what he needs to do to get back in the mix. And you know, I mean, all of this basically just points to Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan being another team like Arrow McLaren has kind of made this surge. Some of that has come from similar, you know, in similar ways, right? Like they've invested heavily in resourcing up basically to be able to compete with the top teams. And they've shown that that's possible to do with the right people and the right drivers and the right kind of mentality. So, you know, all of this to me just points to the IndyCar series becoming even more stacked basically going forward.
Well, I think it's funny you mention that, and it kind of links into what we're going to talk about next. But also, I think it's really important to consider that, like, unlike other motorsport series that you might watch, you know, a lot of those are kind of strict two-car teams in most cases. Whereas if we're looking at IndyCar, you've got 13 cars across Andretti, Penske, Ganassi, and Arrow McLaren SP. So when people in IndyCar get not excited, but are very respectful about like a 12th place finish or something, which just wouldn't happen in Formula One. Like no one's going to, you know, if you're 10th, people don't even actually really, you know, care about that, although it is a point. So, you know, that does have, you know, driver or constructors championship implications. But I think what I'm getting at is the reason why it's so much more respected in a series like IndyCar is because, you know, I've just mentioned the basically the top teams in the series there. And by the way, Ray Hall had the best average finish across their three cars last season of any of those teams. So when you're trying to compete against that, you're not just competing against, you know, like if you're trying to fight for a win in Formula One, you've got Red Bull and Ferrari and Mercedes at six cars. In IndyCar, you've got a, you know, you've got so many cars to compete against, and it's just even scoring a top 15 is, it's not like a win because that's, you know, playing it down massively, but it's, I think it's a lot more valuable than it can be in other championships. And talking about that, I wanted to ask you about Hunkos and Callum Ilott, because again, as we said at the start of the show, we don't always talk about qualifying necessarily that much on the pod because we have so much to get through in terms of the races, but Callum Ilott missed out on pole by like a thousandth of a second. And by the way, a thousandth of a second on the guy who's just broken the record for, you know, the number of IndyCar poles. And the fact that they were, you know, 25th in qualifying last year with a total kind of, I don't even know how you would describe their team last year. You know, they came back with for three races at the end of last season with a totally temporary crew. That's what you can call them. So a lot of those people are not there now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Callum said in the press conference yesterday, I think he'd said they'd started the season with three sets of dampers and one of them was an oval set. And just kind of, you know, it's a team that is, it has the backing that it needs, but it's still very early in its kind of development curve, even though it had taken on some, you know, some parts and some kind of technical knowledge from Carlin, which, you know, is not a front running IndyCar team that you're kind of taking from there. So it's not like a Meyer Shank situation where you're grabbing the car that Colton Hurt has destroyed the field with at some track at some point earlier in the season. You know, this is a totally different scenario. So from your experience in terms of, you know, knowing how important data is and how valuable that can be over the course of a weekend, how much more kind of respect does that give you for what Hunkos has done as a one car team coming in with a totally new crew, an even different crew to what they did, you know, the three races last year with a rookie driver, and to see them kind of, you know, start on the front row and regularly be, you know, at least close to being top 10 contention in qualifying every week.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. They've flown under the radar just in terms of us, you know, whatever, us talking about them, other people talking about them more frequently, just because they haven't, for a variety of reasons, really converted the pace that we've seen them have up through qualifying, whether that be practice or qualifying itself, on a lot of weekends on race day, basically. But this, obviously, this one was no fault of their own. Like, he was looking good for a top five or six probably when it was all said and done. You know, I guess I think that part of it is the data, but even more than that, with a one car team, it's just you're so insanely dependent on, you are just completely dependent on your own engineering staff to make decisions, to make the right decisions, to figure out how to make the car better. I mean, like, you've got, you know, even from when I raced full time last, you know, every team gets like fastest lap data from it's possible to like get a hold of more of this information now through the sort of, I don't know, whatever built in system of data and analytics for the series. So it's possible to see like where you're losing time in the way that you would against a teammate, you know, against other drivers. But then that's just like the first part of actually improving your performance as a group. So the fact that they're able to work with so little from that perspective and manage to not, I mean, you so typically look at these situations that like you start out a weekend and you roll off the truck pretty good and you just can't keep up basically over the course of the weekend with a three-car Penske team, a four-car Ganassi team, a four-car Andretti team getting better over the course of the weekend. And so that to me is the thing that's been most impressive from this squad, both Callum himself, to be able to go out there and just find the pace basically and continue to find the pace. Like, he's obviously got a natural knack for going and being able to go hunt it down, basically. But then on the team side, for them to just make the five decisions that they get to make between second, you know, between the start of second practice and Q3, to make those, it seems like they make the right decision about as frequently as any other team does. So that's the thing to me, looking at this organization, that you gotta be, I mean, Ricky's gotta be buoyed by the performance that they've had this year for that reason, looking at adding an extra car, that it's for sure, even if you don't get a lot of added data out of, I mean, you will, but even if that didn't help you, just the fact that you'll be able to try twice as much stuff in the same amount of time is an extremely significant advantage. So they've been super impressive, and I'm glad that you brought them up, because it's definitely worth a shout out here at the end of the season.
Yeah, definitely. I think the a couple of other kind of things to throw in the shoe pot there, I guess, you know, Callum is one of these young drivers, not unique in any way, who's come up through the ladder fighting for whatever it's going to be the next year, you know, whether it's, you know, getting the funding, getting the right team, being in the right situation year to year. And he's come into this situation with Juncos where, yeah, Ricardo Juncos really, you know, believes in him, believes that he's the right driver for this team to drive it forward. And, you know, he's given him, you know, two contracts now, and also just given him a level of freedom that Callum knows that if he puts the car off, or if he makes a mistake trying to improve this team or trying to find the time that they need, that that's okay. And that's a strategy that, you know, Ricardo is happy to, well, he's not happy to crash cars or to have damage or to go up.
He's committed to doing it.
Yeah, yeah. He's provided a working environment for Callum that he can go out there and know that he can make those mistakes and get the learning that he and the team needs through that process, which is not always the case when you hear about some of the pressure pack situations that some of these drivers go into and have to deliver under. It definitely feels like Callum, you know, has fallen into a really cool scenario there. I think he and Yves Theron have built up a really good relationship as well. Obviously he's an engineer who'd be, you know, well known around the paddock to many people, who's been around a long time now, working with some really significant drivers in the past. So
I worked with Yves, he was my first IndyCar engineer when I filled it on my IndyCar debut. Yves was my guy.
Did you not get where I was going when I was saying he's worked with some really significant drivers?
I did not even remotely think that you were referencing that I've worked with them.
I was thinking of Jimmy Vassa, you know, people like this. But yeah, that relationship has clearly, you know, worked very well. And I guess just to build on some of the things you were saying there, I think the qualifying performance, which I raised initially actually, but some of the things you said after that are very significant in this, is that I think the fact that they're able to go and perform consistently well in qualifying, you know, qualifying in IndyCar is definitely not easy, but it's clear that the combination of the base setup that they have and Callum, you know, being able to extract what's needed out of that car is significant in a qualifying context. I think some of those where we see them maybe falter a little bit in the races is things like either turning the tires on or looking after the tires over the course of a stint, which is where some of the bigger teams are really making big gains in things like damper development and stuff like that. Obviously, that's where a lot of the turning the tires on comes from. And just general setup work that keeps the tires alive over long stints. But I think Laguna Seca was looked like a big win for Juncos in that sense, because I know Callum dropped back a little bit at the start, but that felt like, you know, Callum driving conservatively to try and, you know, basically not get crashed off or do anything, yeah, or put himself in a position where he was going to lose 10 spots instead of losing two or three. And once he was kind of settled there, he stayed there and he wasn't moving. So I just think, I'm just really, it seems like every time they make a step forward, it's in the most unexpected place, and it's in such a huge way that it's so surprising based on what they're working with. Because even like the step forward that they made in the street course package, you know, it felt like they were, when we turned up at St. Pete, they were not good. They were really not good. And Callum, you know, used those words himself, like, and to see the how fast they've progressed, when you consider we know how much it is going into a Penske and a Ganassi and an Andretti and an Arrow McLaren SP organization, and you compare that to what Juncos has been able to do, and it's pretty outstanding. So I'm glad we got the chance to talk about them. We'll definitely have Callum on the pod as well to talk about some of the, I guess, lots of different things, including junior single-seater ladders, because that seems to be a good topic at the moment. So we'll definitely pick that up with him. I wanted to work through just a quick bit of housekeeping, I guess, before we leave, and just run through the championship standings as things finish here. Will Power on 560 points, Joseph Newgard on 544, Scott Dixon on 521, Scott McLaughlin with that last lap pass on Romain Grosjean equaled Alex Palou's points count and actually beats him on a count back for a number of wins. So both Scott McLaughlin and Alex Palou on 510 points, but McLaughlin gets fourth and Alex Palou gets fifth because of that count back. Marcus Ericsson in sixth on 506 points. So yeah, that's the end of our Laguna Seca podcast. Like I said, make sure you check back wherever you listen to your podcasts, whatever platform it is you use, because we will hopefully, all things being considered, be back with Will Power very, very shortly. So we're looking forward to that. JR will be with me for that as well, I hope, unless you've got more important things to do. But I'm sure you'll make that a priority.
I'll have to check my schedule, Jack.
Meanwhile, make sure you keep on with the-race.com, where we'll have all of the latest features and news regarding the title finale and some of the interesting off-season and silly season stuff that's going on. If you've got anything to say about the pod, you can email us podcasts, that's with an S at the end, at the-race.com. You can send us a voice note and be included on the podcast if you want. If you've got a question for us, please let us know. Or if you've got any recommendations or people that you'd like to listen to on the podcast, let us know. We'll see what we can do. That being said, it's time to go to bed and really enjoy some sleep after a very intense Laguna Seca finale. We'll be back later this week with Will Power. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.